Hey, welcome to another edition of Stuck at Home. Today I'm talking to my good friend, Ophir Gottlieb. He runs a company called CML Wiz. And the reason I'm talking to him is because, like everyone else who reads my blog and listens to this podcast, I'm confused about the stock market. And especially given what's going on in the real world and how stock market is behaving. And I thought, why not ask him as to what's happening? Maybe we can talk a little bit about Robinhood, the Robinhood effect, and you know, how we should all be thinking about the markets and the economy. Hey, so welcome.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for having me. Stuck at home.
So tell us a little bit about like what you do and what your company does, and how your approach is different from what other people have done in the past, so that everyone who's listening can actually get a better context on your view of the markets.
Sure, it's my pleasure. My background professionally was in institutional finance, and I learned over the years, over the decades, that there is an information asymmetry between what retail investors get and what the institutions get. And in all fairness, I was, you know, incidentally, a part of that asymmetry, because I was running research for institutions. And then after we sold the last company, the founder came to me and he said, hey, let's, the founder is James Kaplan. He's sort of one of the grandfathers of modern portfolio theory. He came to me and said, hey, what do you think about doing something about retail investors essentially getting, you know, a drip of information compared to the fire hose that institutions get? And the truth of the matter is, when he first introduced the idea to me, I wasn't interested. and so eventually, with some coaxing, he got me into it. And so fundamentally, the difference between us and, let's say, anything else out there is that I'm bringing interviews with CEOs and institutional research, but primarily to retail investors. I mean, obviously we have a lot of large institutions and hedge funds who follow us, who subscribe to us, but I'm just trying to level the playing field. And that's offered me through my years of, you know, as a market maker and all these things, it's given me a lot of perspective. I've seen a lot in my life in this little space that we call finance or markets. And being exposed to the retail world it's also been eye-opening to see everybody has a cognitive dissonance. It's just, you know, where do they lie? And so fundamentally, I try to help people recognize their own cognitive dissonance when it comes to investing, and how, with the proper perspective, they're the best investors in the world. They can outperform every hedge fund there is by simply having perspective. Perspective is a superpower.
What I wanted to ask you is, like, so you still, you know, given, you know, how much information we have on the internet and everything that is out there, you still think that there is a lot of information asymmetry between the public, you know, like the large investors and the small investors? Or, I mean, or has that gap been narrowed? It's like when I was writing about the markets and covering the markets, which I'm talking about 1992, 93 onwards, and it was like a totally different world where everything looked completely like, you know, you were dependent on the middlemen to get the real good information, which is the real good information was essentially at that time analyst reports and recommendations from big institutions. But, like, you know, and then when the internet came along, a lot of that just went away. I mean, you think there is still an information asymmetry between the retail investors and the professional investors?
Yeah, I think it's actually gotten worse. So I actually spoke to Vala Afshar about this. I see there are three waves in financial technology. And the first wave was, you know, the internet. And we went from people getting stock quotes from a newspaper a day later to having access to stock quotes in real time and the ability to trade freely of your own volition without having to call another human being who may or may not agree with you. And that was a really, really big step. The next step was the democratization of financial data beyond price, right? Beyond price and access. So financial statements, analyst reports, various derived data. But we're in the third wave now. So what has happened with that? We have more people with access, and we have more people with access with information. What that has really created is created more confusion. So there are more people seeing more things that don't make sense. And so the final wave is going to be turning information, or really what I like to call it, turning data into information. And information just means a decision-making process such that you can remove cognitive biases. And I think we have never been in a weaker place with regard to the ability to decipher between what is noise and what is in fact information aiding data. And so it is precisely at this time that we are totally overwhelmed with information. We're totally overwhelmed with data and totally underwhelmed with respect to information.
And why is that? Like, why do you think we are in that situation? Is it because there are no systems which help us discern, you know, between signal and noise?
There's a lot. Ultimately, what you said is probably the best way to say it, but there's a proliferation of agents of data, proliferation of agents that deliver the data. So we can say a financial media, which a financial medium can be both television or now obviously on the internet or both. There is still some written word. There are still some newspapers being printed. But with that proliferation comes the competition to be profitable. They must survive. This idea that news, you know, news is there to provide news, I mean, that died a long time ago. It died really when Ted Turner decided to create something called the cable news network. And now all of a sudden there was a network of news 24 hours a day, and they had to fill that. And that became sensationalized and has been repeated for various political biases over and over and over again. And then the rest of the media just caught on. So why are there so many articles on one stock versus another? Is it because there's more news about it? No, it's because a certain stock, say Apple or Amazon, they get more clicks, and more clicks means more revenue, and more revenue means they can do it again. And so I would say that there has been sort of this disconnect between the import of a story existing and the need to just print something. And so it used to be that if a story was written, big or small, it had a purpose. The purpose was to deliver some bit of information, even if it was local news, international news, or domestic news. And now the sole purpose of most news, and we can stick with finance, is just, the point of its existence is just to exist. It must fill the quota of search engine optimization place in Google, and perhaps in a news feed in Facebook or Twitter, but doesn't actually tell us anything. It's oftentimes the same canonical source. That is, the data comes from a place, and that data is presented, not even interpreted, is presented in 13 different ways when the data itself is good enough. And in those ways, you get 13 different conclusions, all of which are likely written by people who aren't experts, all of which are partially true, partially false, all of which simply create confusion. And that is why one source can create two stories, one saying absolutely with authority, position A, and the other saying with absolute authority, position opposite A. It's the same data. And those stories exist not to help bring information. Those stories exist simply so they can exist. And that's a not a good place for anything. Since we're not talking about politics, we'll just talk about finance. It's not a good place for finance. It's not a good place for finance. And while obviously we had to go through stage one of this transformation where people could access their own money and their own information and trade their own assets, we had to have that. The influx of noise that has come with that has probably hurt people's wealth more than it's helped it. And my best evidence of that because that's quite a statement, right? Here's my best circumstantial evidence. For the last 79 years, just call it 80 years, the stock market has been up 4 out of 5 years on average. So 80%. And by the way, it's absolutely fair criticism to say that's an arbitrary choice, January 1st to December 31st. But that's just what I did. I took a year. Okay, so it's up 4 out of 5 years. It turns out the down years are down smaller than an average up year. And I know everyone out there thinks that a bear market is worse than a bull market. False. The average down year is smaller than the average up year. And the average up year happens 4 times as often as a down year. It's actually very, very difficult to lose wealth in the stock market. I'm not talking about turning $1 into $1 billion. I'm saying it's difficult to put money in the market and at some point later in the future to not have more, whatever more means. Yet that is what continues to happen over and over again. How can that be? Are we going to take the stance that people are stupid? Because I don't live in that world. I don't look at a group of people, especially, you know, just retail investors are dumb. False. So how can that possibly be? It's because this thing, money, is tied very much to our identity of self and to fear. We don't want to lose our identity. We don't want to lose our wealth. And because of that, it's driven by emotion. And that emotion is stoked by the proliferation of basically shitty news. And it has turned this magnificent apparatus to invest essentially in the best companies in America in a very organized, rule-based system that goes up 4 times more often than it goes down. And when it goes up more than it goes down. And somehow that has turned into code word for gambling. So gambling is when you have a negative edge and the house is building something off of that, like a hotel. This is not gambling. This is pretty easy wealth creation, but we're not creating wealth for the retail investor. And it is my hypothesis that we're not creating wealth for the retail investor because of this data dump.
Or information asymmetry, as we were talking about. I think, you know, this is one of the things I wanted to actually, you know, explore more with you. And I think you and I have privately discussed this. You know, the market, since the time I was covering them, I don't cover them at all anymore. But they, you know, there was a semblance of like, there were lanes the market used to, you know, you would drive in. And like, you know, and whenever there was all this talk about insider information, it was essentially information as an edge towards like, you know, future events. And so you could profit from it. And now just we see events happening in the market to drive the market itself. So what I'm trying to say is that, you know, we have such a logarithmic trading now that machines are just looking for, you know, triggers, you know, to do, you know, trading. Essentially, there is no other reason just to look for more articles or more, you know, more press release or more noise about a certain stock, and you suddenly see that stock popping up. So you think that change is become more and more pervasive, or is it like my perception is entirely just like, you know, me smoking too much crazy stuff?
No, I think your perception is accurate and based in fact. There are more trading algorithms with more assets behind them actively touching the market than ever before. And just like the growth in data, we will see a continued growth in that. But I would say that if you really think about it and have perspective, it doesn't matter at all. I mean, unless we're talking to a group of people that try to trade second by second and therefore are competing with algorithms, which I've built, by the way, and sold, it doesn't really matter day to day. I mean, why is there such fanaticism about 6:30 a.m. Pacific time to 1 p.m. Pacific time every day and how a stock moves. Who cares? The market is a wealth-building apparatus which takes perspective and patience. Perspective is a fancy word for saying proper risk management, right? You don't sell everything and then buy everything and sell everything and then buy everything. The noise machine that has created noise reading machines, algorithms, they have no impact materially that I can see on a long-term investor, other than the impact they have on our cognition. We're reading things that really don't actually matter, but they sure feel like they do. It feels like it should matter. This thing, this move in the market really feels like it should matter. And since it feels like it should matter, it probably does matter, right? And since it probably does matter, I think I'm going to sell. If that information or noise never came out, then we would be sitting here happily, not using the stock market as entertainment, building wealth in whichever way we feel most sensitive, most comfortable. So I don't think that the influx of algorithmic trading has done that much. I think it has actually improved liquidity. But for a retail investor, that doesn't matter either, really. I mean, you know, it's not, retail investors are not buying 5, 10, 25, $30 million blocks of stock, usually. There's plenty of liquidity. I don't think the algorithms matter. Does that, you know, if we were to go myopic, take a magnifying glass, an electron microscope, and really dive deep into each daily candle, is money being extracted from these machines from other people? Yeah, I mean, you could make that argument. I don't know, but it's possible. I'm not trying to say it's not happening. But what I'm saying is nobody cares about what's under the microscope. Stop looking at a microscope. It doesn't matter. In fact, it does matter. It'll hurt you if you focus on it. If you stop focusing on it, you're going to do just fine. Basically, the stock market is an apparatus to test your mettle for perspective. Can you fight non-stop quasi-information? And quasi-information can also be large stock moves. You know, Jay Powell says something and, oh my God, the market's up and then it's down and there's a tweet. And are we able to understand that everything that's coming in is totally useless, other than crucial pieces that are about the company, that do not come quickly, they come over time, good or bad? Obviously, I'm not talking about, like, you know, the revelation of a fraud, okay? That's bad. But in the normal swing of things, it just doesn't matter. Let us as retail investors not think about what they're doing under the electron microscope. That's their business. Our business is to build our wealth so we can help our families, our loved ones, whatever it is that our goals are to do with our money. Let us not be entertained. Let us simply be efficient.
But let me ask you another, like, a related question. One of the biggest challenges of current times, and I'm not talking about financial markets, I'm talking about just reality, is that we've all become very short-term oriented. Our attention spans have been fractionalized. We do not pay attention to the long-term at all. And, you know, we've totally become, you know, creatures of the Twitch, you know, not the net Twitch, the platform, but we are a twitching generation now, right? Look around us. How do you kind of start thinking about long-term value and long-term growth and, you know, asset, you know, valuation going up over the long time in such an environment which, you know, it's like, it's not even possible at times, I feel, to even, like, not think beyond the now. I would love to know how you think about it.
Yeah, it's very well said. And, you know, without I'm not blaming any one social medium. It's just funny to say we used to read books and now we read 140 characters. Like that's a perfect, well, I guess it's 280 characters now. That's a perfect example of where we've gone from long-term to short-term. So if we're talking about finance, that's really my battle every day. So I try to read 100 to 200 pages a day of financial material, and 75% of it is intentionally just the noise. Since I can't escape it, I try to consume all of it because that's the only way my brain works. I can't pretend it's not there because then I get anxious. So I just, instead of pretending it's on there, I do the opposite. I just welcome all of it in and I read all of it. And as I start reading all of it, I start getting conflicting opinions and I realize, okay, this is nothing, but at least I've done it. I do it every day. And if we're talking about not finance, I do very similar things, right? We have this, obviously this global health pandemic driven by a coronavirus. Even the information coming about that can be very confusing. And from what I think we would hope are well-meaning people, still contradictory, not maybe contradictory meaningfully on its import, but maybe contradictory on its progress or its danger or the length of time it will be here or the ability to have a vaccine. The exercise for me is to consume all of it. And because I consume all of it, I can discard it. I think it might be a healthier version of the world for myself if I consumed none of it. But I have a weakness that I have to read it. So that's what I do. I just try to consume all of it, knowing full well that my wonderful emotional waves, I know when I start that I'm going to go through these wonderful emotional waves. Since we're humans, we tend to go to despair more often than we go anywhere else, so into despair. And then I know when I come out of it and I'm done, I'm going to say, well, okay, well, that's over. And now I feel better. That's how I do it. I'm a consumer of the information. I go to some of the worst websites. So not truly garbage, but the ones where I know they're very biased. They pretend that they're coming without prejudicial views, but I know full well there's a prejudicial view. And I consume it. I take their prejudicial view. I become manipulated by their prejudice. I fall for it and I do it over and over and over so that when I'm done with my reading, it's all gone. I'm cured. And that's the only way I can think long-term is to just consume all of the short-term and then discard it. I think that, like I said, it would be healthier if people would just discard it altogether, but I can't do that.
You know, the other question when we started talking, I wanted to ask you was about Robinhood, and it seems like such a phenom and like everybody seems to be talking about it. I would love to understand how you think about it, especially in the context of what you and I have just talked about, the twitchiness in our culture now. Like, what do you make of it? When I was a young punk reporter, I used to cover ECN, you know, Instinet, and there was like one, I think there was a Shadows, which was owned by Bear Stearns, and, you know, there was like, I covered all these things. Well, I wrote for Traders Magazine back in the day. So, and I'm looking at Robinhood, and it feels like it's like ECNs for everyone else, and, you know, dark pools of money for everyone else. I don't know. What do you think of it? And like, how do you explain the Robinhood phenomena?
I think my opinion on Robinhood's a little bit different. I don't think Robinhood is actually that big of a deal. I think what's a big deal is that Schwab went commission-free. And once Schwab went commission-free, possibly influenced by Robinhood, but I'm not sure we weren't going there anyway. I'm resisting giving Robinhood more credit than it deserves. We were going to zero commissions anyway. Once Schwab went commission-free, then I think there has been more market participation, more focused on what you would call twitches, than before. So I think that's true. I don't think it matters for the long term. I think that the people doing that are going to hurt their wealth, but that's not for me to decide. I'm not their father or their brother. So I'm not sure. Commission-free trading is a phenomenon. It has, I think, increased risk appetite or at least risk behavior, whether people realize they have an increased risk appetite. And for those people, they're probably going to spin their wheels and probably not go anywhere. But for the investor with perspective, it really just gives us much more edge. The more noise that is acted upon by the investors without perspective, the more value there is to the investor that can have that perspective. And you can only see that value difference in measuring the wealth accumulation of the people who, let's say, are doing the Robinhood phenomenon. Although I don't think all Robinhood traders are the same. I don't think it's an amalgamation of one type of trader. I think there's a lot of very smart retail investors who are just trying to build their wealth. But the difference between the return of the investor without perspective versus the return of the investor with perspective is going to grow. And I think that's how you can measure somehow empirically what I'm saying. I would just like to throw one thing out there, but for Robinhood, I think there are a lot of people joining Robinhood who should be in the market. Right? They're young. They have some excess capital. Doesn't have to be a big number. Could be a big number. They should invest in the best wealth building apparatus that requires very little capital. You do not need more than $100 to get in the market, right? So I applaud Robinhood for doing that. I don't think every Robinhood trader is the same. And I don't think focusing on the behavior of Robinhood traders is really any more than an article from a shitty finance website that just likes to tag ticker Amazon. It just doesn't matter. It doesn't.
So how are you reading the current market then? Like, what's going on, and like, how should we all be thinking about opportunities, investing, especially from a tech perspective?
I think the first thing we need to do is to understand there's, I think, a very harmful narrative that's out there, which says that we're taking unprecedented steps to battle a recession. And that's actually not quite right. We are taking unnatural steps to combat an unnatural act. It's unnatural for the government to have shut down the economy. It was right. It was needed due to a health pandemic, but it's not, let us not call this a business cycle. This is not a business cycle. This is not capitalism. Survival of the fittest. So Darwinian capitalism. It is not. It is the death of companies due to the imposition of the shutdown of business for good reason. Therefore, since it is an unnatural shock to the system, we must take unnatural remedies. It cannot be that we do the normal things when the thing we've created is not normal. It is unnatural what we did. It should be that our actions are also unnatural. Things that were never on the table, like universal income, should now be on the table. Maybe not forever, but for a period of time. Things that would never have been considered mainstream should be considered mainstream. They're unnatural, but that's because we're dealing with an unnatural economic impact. And so once we have that perspective, we can then understand that we're living in a world where there's going to be a period of time where there's unnatural things happening in everything finance related. We're going to have unnaturally low mortgage rates. We're going to have unnaturally high requirements to get a mortgage. We're going to have unnatural movements in the stock market. Of course we are. Can you imagine if we weren't? What if we had the fewest days of volatility this year than ever before? Wouldn't that be the alarm? Isn't it comforting that we're having great volatility? Isn't that a mark that the system is working? I mean, what is it that people wanted? Nice, calm reactions to an unnatural economic imposition and an unnatural government and Federal Reserve reaction? No, it should be really, really volatile. We should see things like the worst bear market ever followed by the best 50-day recovery ever. That should give us comfort. It should be unnatural. So what's happening in the market? The market is behaving in an unnatural way. I feel much more comfortable with the market behaving like this than I would if there was no volatility at all. I would be scared. Now I'm not scared. Now I recognize it's going to get worse. But the thing is, it's going to get better after it gets worse. Right? It's going to be terrible. But then it's going to get better after it's terrible. And in the meantime, it's going to be unnatural. But it's going to be natural after it gets unnatural. These are the things that should be happening. The market is behaving overall rationally because it is infected, poor use of term, sorry, because it is being influenced by unnatural things.
One of the arguments I've heard from many people about the market, the way it's behaving right now, is that it seems like we are cycling out of the past of the American economy and cycling into the future of American economy, aka going from the old world into more digital oriented, companies, more digital, more technology centric products. I mean, is that a safe statement from your perspective, like how you look at the market, or you think it's too simplistic?
No, I think it's actually not simplistic at all. I think it is correct. I don't think it's simplistic at all. It's actually as in-depth as it should be. It's perfectly accurate. I speak to a lot of CEOs and CFOs of public companies, and I don't think I've spoken to one in the last quarter that hasn't said exactly what you just said. They're talking about their business, but you take the amalgamation of all of their comments and turn it into a macro view, and it's exactly what you said. The digital transformation was going to happen anyway. It's just been fast-forwarded, and then you look at silos within that. It's been fast-forwarded anywhere from a quarter to 5 years. You look at like digital remote health monitoring. That's been thrust forward 3 years. I talked to the CEO of a company called Livongo, Zane Burke, and he just said it. He said, we're 3 years forward. It just happened. And believe me, he's not celebrating COVID. I talked to, the founder of Fastly, an edge cloud provider. Same thing. The edge was going to happen. The internet was the superstar of the lockdown. And as much as we were going to do on the internet anyway, it's just been thrust forward. So if I'm going to have my money invested in United States public companies at this time, in a time where it's uncharted risk, right? It's uncharted risk. That's why we had the greatest the greatest drop for bear ever and the greatest recovery ever. And we're still here in some weird no man's land. If I'm going to be investing in this, then I'm going to invest in the companies that are going to be helping the world move forward with the digital transformation. And should those asset values go up and down a lot, I look at it and say, good, they should be going up and down a lot. It's really unnatural right now, but that's where I'm going to put my money. And that is where I put my money.
Okay. So if, I'm not going to ask you about specific picks because that's not why I wanted to talk to you. But I do want to ask you is that, some of these tech stock valuations are extremely high right now. And so when is a good time to get into the market? And actually, what is the right approach to kind of, bet on this digital future?
Yeah, valuations, depending on how you look at it, and certainly depending on the company, appear stretched. They appear stretched, and it appears even more stretched because, 90 days ago they were compressed. So, if you think of it as a rubber band, it's, really, really stretched. The only way I know how to invest in the stock market consistently to create wealth is pick an area. So you noted the area, right? It's stocks, companies that are enabling the digital transformation in various places. It can be healthcare, it can be in the cloud, it can be, streaming TV, whatever. And to allocate your assets depending on your risk appetite and your ability to have perspective. Either just get in and just hold your nose and don't look for 5 years. Or if you know that that's going to create a problem with your perspective, just dollar cost average. Just do it. Every 15th of the month, you're buying a stock that has been predetermined months before. I have this saying, the Ophir from last month is the decision maker for the Ophir this month. The decision has already been made. Ophir of May has made the decisions for Ophir of June. And so it's one of those two perspectives. There's a lot of data which shows you, in fact, dollar cost averaging costs you money, but that's only if you're a machine. We're not machines. Our perspectives are infected by fear. So dollar cost average if you have to, but this is not, you and I both had front row seats to .com, right? You and I both saw it. Yeah. Full well, eyes wide open. We knew exactly what was going on as it was happening. And you and I both remember the companies, right? These were not real companies and nobody said they were. We have very little of that happening. We have like these headlines about people investing in Hertz rental car, which is bankrupt, and they were going to try and sell stock because their stock was going up so much. Thankfully, the SEC said, actually, you can't do that. But that's really not happening that much. I mean, are companies overvalued? Probably. Are these companies real companies? Most of them are, and that, you know, you can get out a fine tooth comb and look at the financials and look at trends, make sure there's profitability and a strong balance sheet and what their business is. But this isn't then. And I really wouldn't worry that much about valuation other than making sure that whatever path you take doesn't bother your perspective. So if you have to dollar cost average, just do that. Do that. Dollar cost averaging is fantastic because you put some money in. If the market goes down, you're thinking, awesome, I'm putting more money in. I can't wait for it to go down. If it goes up, you're saying, awesome, I'm so glad I'm in. So fix your perspective and do it that way if you like.
Well, this has been a great conversation. Before we go, how can people, work with you and, you know, sign up for your awesome service and, you know, benefit from your intelligence?
Thank you, Om. So, our product that is for stock research, which is what we've been talking about, is called CML Pro. Our company is Capital Market Laboratories. So CML is the acronym. Right. And you can just Google CML Pro, or you can go to cmlviz.com, V-I-Z.com, and on the upper right-hand side, it says learn about CML Pro, something like that. And you can join our community. You know, we're tens of thousands of people or members that give me the added imprimatur to reach out to the CEOs of the cutting edge companies. And that gives us the edge that the institutions have had for far too long. So I encourage all retail investors to at least consider it. I keep it at a price that's, you know, it's, I'm not charging $2,000 a month. I'm charging like $40 a month. I want everyone to get access to it. So you can just Google CML Pro. You'll see a bunch of reviews. And I think that's probably the best way.
Thank you so much for your time. It's been really great talking to you. I mean, I could go on and on and on talking to you, but I don't want to misuse your time and our listeners' time. So thank you, Ophir, and hopefully I'll see you online and, you know, talk more about what's happening in our universe.
Thank you so much for the opportunity, Om. It's truly humbling that you've chosen to speak with me today, and I thank you.
I love your stuff, man. Don't even say that. Thank you.
Thank you, Om. Okay, bye-bye.
Hey, can you just hold on for a minute?
Yeah, of course.